Good morning, everybody. We are going to get started. One of our presenters, or actually commentators, Mark Stokes, got a flat tire this morning, but he is on his way. He promises he will be here momentarily. But I think we should get started since we only have about an hour and a half. I want to thank you all for coming this morning. When I learned last year that the Legislative Yuan in Taiwan had passed an amendment to the National Defense Act to require a review of Taiwan's defense policies every 4 years. I put it on my calendar, on my agenda, to hold this event because I think it's a very, very interesting development that Taiwan is now producing and releasing its QDR. Good morning, Mark, right up here and right on time. So when the QDR was released about a month ago, my understanding is it's still only out in Chinese, although I've been told that there will soon be a full English version. There has been an abstract that has been released by Taiwan that I know I have read, but I have not read the full document in Chinese and look forward to reading that when it comes out. So I've invited here three very excellent top experts on this topic, which their bios are available to you, and I will just introduce them very, very briefly. We're very lucky to have with us today Alexander Huang, who is a professor at Damkang University and also a senior associate with us here at CSIS, and he is usually in Taipei, but comes to visit quite frequently, and we're very, very happy to have the opportunity to have him here today to explain to us the origins and the significance of Taiwan's first quadrennial defense review. After that, he will be followed by Michael Swain, who is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment, and then Mark Stokes, who is the executive director from the Project 2049 Institute. And with that, I will turn the floor over to Alexander.
Well, thank you, Bonnie, and thank you for coming, everyone, this morning. I know today is a busy day in town, and I myself will participate in some other events later on. But thank you for wake up so early for this presentation. This is the first QDR in Taiwan, and some people in Taiwan, when we released to the public, saying that this is the fourth QDR, and I asked them why. They said the first three were from the United States. So Taiwan is the second country release such a document in the same spirit and the same logic. Today I will share with you, because you can download the full Chinese text from the website and abstract in English version. The full English translation version will be available in mid-April, and I think the Deputy Minister of Defense, Mr. Zhang, will sign off and give the green light to put on website on April 7th, I think the MND will put on the website immediately after the signature is done. So today I will just give you some of the highlights that I consider important. I am one of the seven outside advisors to the Ministry of Defense on this QDR. And it includes scholars both from the so-called blue side and the green side, I think, because Taiwan has such a small defense community. So once you want to do anything related to defense, you include everyone. So this document is basically a document of compromise, I would say, because different agencies and units and organizations within the MND wanted to put their view in it and also sometimes insist that their view cannot be changed by the organizer or the drafter. So it's like some reports in this country, in this town, that it's a compromise of different unit and agencies. Secondly, I want to say this is a guideline, because there were a lot of confusions in the very beginning when the Parliament passed the law or amend the National Defense Act, requiring the Ministry of Defense to issue a quadrennial defense review model from the United States. Even some people in uniform argued that since we have National Defense Report every 2 years, why do we need a review? Because review in Chinese means look back. So a lot of people thought that would be a similar document. I think the Ministry of Defense spent a lot of time in their public relations and in engaging with the media in Taipei to make people understand that QDR is a different thing. How different? I receive a lot of phone calls from the representative office of different countries in Taiwan asking me what's the difference between your National Defense Report every 2 years and the new QDR. And here is the account of differences. Of course, the Article 30 of National Defense Act require the Ministry of Defense to report, to issue reports make it public so the general citizens would understand what had been done by the Ministry of Defense. In practice, this has been done every 2 years. But for QDR, it's a requirement. It has a time requirement. In Article 30 of National Defense Act, it did not specify when you need to put up or put out a National Defense Report. But by Article 31 of National Defense Act, it requires the government to issue the QDR within 10 months of each presidential inauguration. So there is a timeline. And also, they have different objectives. I think the QDR is designed to give, especially the lawmakers, a general idea that what the new president or the new government will do in the next 4 years. So it talks more on the strategy, on the requirement, on the force structure, and not a comprehensive report of the jobs or works that have been done by the Ministry of Defense. So the scope are different, the characteristics are different, and I think the biggest challenge for the team to come up with the QDR was that when Taiwan had only National Defense Report, knowing that there were other country issuing a white paper like Japan, South Korea, Thailand, the People's Republic, and also the United States had the QDR since 1997. So in the previous National Defense Report, the writers or the editors kept in mind that they have a lot of references. So they also put the QDR as a reference. So when people look at and compare the National Defense Report in the previous years and the QDR, they probably will found some overlapping structure. I think the only reason was because that we had only one report, and the QDR issued by Pentagon were our reference in the previous National Defense Report. I had written several articles and been interviewed, and it's at your hand as a reference, so I would not go through everything that I have written. But I have to say that personally, sit down with the officials in the Ministry of Defense for a little bit more than 4 months, meeting almost every week on this document. I think there are two themes for this document. First is prevention. Everything that Taiwan military does will work for one objective, is prevention. How to prevent a conflict in the Taiwan Strait. And the approaches are comprehensive, because when people talk about deterrence, or the term that Taiwan used for decades, effective deterrence, in the past, a lot of people were thinking of, in purely military terms, that Taiwan will buy and build the capability that can project power against the other side of the Taiwan Strait. So can we deter the military assault from China? But with this administration, the Ma Ying-jeou administration, I myself went through a difficult period to digest what President Ma has said in public, because he usually talk about better cross-strait relationship, smart diplomacy, and a lot of things that non-military as part of the deterrence or part of the prevention measures. So I think the QDR take Ma Ying-jeou's philosophy or his idea that prevention is not purely based on military means, but also through diplomatic and relationship with democracies, and also a better managed cross-strait relationship. The second theme is transformation. I will talk about why Taiwan need to transform. This is not by, you know, borrowing a term or a specific name from the United States or trying to play smart. Taiwan has more than a dozen of reasons that we must transform. This is a imposed transformation. And no one, no matter who would be the minister, who would be the president, Taiwan military must transform because of several reasons that I will talk about it later. Transformation is to change. But the direction is correct. I think both opposition and the ruling party agree that Taiwan military needs to transform, but how to do it? And how can we better off after this transformation remains to be seen, and there have been a lot of question marks. And if the job is easy, I think everybody can be the defense minister. But this is a very challenging task for Taiwan military in the coming years. I think from the abstract that you seen on the website or downloaded, you will see that there are four parts of the QDR. First, talk about the threat assessment, and secondly, talking about defense policies, defense strategy, and national military strategy. Third part would be the policies. Are the policies that the MND would carry out in the coming year to transform the military? And lastly, are the targeted capabilities that the Taiwan military intended to achieve? Given some highlights of a required or imposed or necessary transformation, the first one is defense reorganization. It's not easy in Taiwan. Remember, back in 2004, there were a public activity during the presidential campaign to form human chain across the island. Now Taiwan has only 275,000 men and women in uniform. If they try to form a human chain to defend Taiwan, they can go from Keelung to probably Danshui, that's it. So we are defending Taiwan in a different form. And the modern nature of warfare would force us to change the mindset and concept of defense. There will be further cut in the next, I would say, 5 to 6 years of another 60,000 troops in the Taiwan military. And the commanding headquarters will reduce from 6 to 3, and basically the 3 commands will be eliminated, are the Logistic Command, Reserve Command, and the Military Police. They will be transformed or move their responsibility to be under different command. For force modernization logistics, that means when army building logistics, it will go to the Armament Bureau. But for operational logistics, it goes back to the services. I think that's a decision not only to streamline the military commands, but also to be more specific and make the services command more responsible. For reserve command, that has been debated for a long time. I directed 2 theses, master degree theses on this subject. And the conclusion that I had always supported was to eliminate the reserve command and put the reserve brigades under the administrative and operational control of the Army Corps. Or otherwise, when you have an Army command and a reserve command, and it cannot work that well when a contingency occurred abruptly. So that has been done this time. For military police, the biggest meaning is that previously the military police has a law enforcement duty that they, by law, they could arrest civilians if requested by the law enforcement agencies and directed by prosecutors. And now the QDR pronounced that the military police will no longer possess that capacity, and it will be limited only to regulate service personnel. And there will be further cut of non-combat unit and transform a lot of works to contractors. This is to a trans... before we, when Taiwan had more soldiers in the barracks, we... Thank you so much. We could have, a platoon of private soldiers just sweeping the street. But right now, all these kind of works were contract out. No longer that uniformed people doing that kind of administrative and support works. And also, the QDR pronounced that they will increase the ratio of civilian officers in the Ministry of Defense. They don't give details because QDR is a framework. It's a guideline. So I think based on the QDR spirit or the guideline of QDR, the Ministry of Defense is required to roll out detailed plans for implementation of those principles. Secondly, that related to military service is the reform of the the compulsory service. For a lot of people, when Taiwan talk about implementing an all-volunteer forces, including my students in the college, believe that they will have nothing to do with uniform service in lifetime. But in reality, the all-volunteer forces concept, which will be implemented in Taiwan, is different from the idea that my student got. We still have a military service, we call military training service, or 军事训练役. So based on our constitution, all men, all people has to serve in the military. And right now we shift that from a 11-month as current policy, we change that to 4 months of service. And the service will carry out in two stages. The first stage will be 6 weeks boot camp training during college year, one of the summers that all young men will have to go to Taichung, as I did before, for 6 weeks boot camp training. That's very basic. And after they graduate, there will be another 10 weeks of training, which in there that people will be specified as artillery or infantry and other specifications. For those who are not participating in the college, they will serve 4 months in one row and in one stage. And after they complete the 16 weeks of training service, they will be put on reserve. Approximately before the anyone reach the age of 35, they are subject to mobilization on the annual basis. So every year, by different tiers, people will be called back to the barracks and serve for from 1 week to 3 weeks of mobilization training. So after the 4 month basic training, you will have another 15 years listed as reserve enlisted soldiers or airmen or seamen. So the all volunteer forces concept is definitely not a policy change. It's a transformation, and as you can see in the previous slides, I said the defense reorganization will be done between 2011 and 2014. It goes along with the plan of the execution of the all-volunteer forces. So Taiwan has another, 18 months to 2 years to adjust and make available all the laws and requirements. Taiwan will also reinstate the ROTC program that they tried before for several years and stopped around 5 years ago, and it will be reinstated, and also refining the NCO program. Thirdly, I would say the QDR, there were a lot of confusion because Taiwan has this 10-year modernization planning, 5-year force structure, and annual readiness plan, and running that for more than 2 decades. So all the uniformed people, all the people in the joint staff were very familiar with this 10-5-1 intervals. And when the law requires the Ministry of Defense to have a QDR with a 4-year interval, there were a lot of confusions. I sit down with different staffers in J3, J1, J5, and Strategic Planning Department. And finally, the high authority determined that they will use the QDR as the guideline to monitor and put the 10-year modernization planning and 5-year force structuring under a two-year review intervals. So every 2 years, the 10-5 planning will be review under the guidance of QDR. And also, lastly, there were talks about building up asymmetrical capabilities. I think the asymmetrical capability does not involve in anything wild. It's just trying to find a so-called innovative ways of operation and the doctrines to conduct warfare. And I think we are still in the very, very early stage to develop or further confine or further refine the concepts of asymmetrical capabilities with Taiwan's own definition. And also, I listed several points of the current challenges the Ministry of Defense are facing. I think those are important issues that should be looked at. Probably I would share with you these views during the Q&A session.
Okay. Thank you very much, Alexander. I'm sure we'll have time to come back to the last couple of slides during the Q&A. Next, we're going to turn to Michael Swain.
Thank you, Bonnie. I apologize up front. I have a chest cold, so we'll be lucky if I get through. So I have I'm not going to attempt to sort of provide a comprehensive assessment of either the QDR or of Alexander's commentary presentation, but I'll just try and bring up a few issues. I think it's important to begin with an understanding about actually what it is that Alex brings up at the end here by way of context. Understanding the QDR, I think you have to place it in a as you do with all these defense documents, in a larger context of what is going on in Taiwan and what the Taiwan government confronts. Even though the document itself, I think, was developed through the Integrated Assessments Office, is that right? I mean, that sounds like a very professional, straightforward, technical organization that developed this. And I'm sure they had major input into it, but I think it's probably pretty clear that this whole process was also embedded within a much larger set of criteria and understandings. And I just want to tick off some of those factors and then discuss how I think this document addresses some of these challenges. We all know about the military challenge. What is, at the very least, a potentially, if not actually, declining military deterrence capability that Taiwan faces in looking at the mainland? The recent DOD PLA report, if you looked at it, stated, interestingly, that when it issued a previous report or some years ago, it stated that the cross-strait military balance and the air balance in particular was in many ways in Taiwan's favor, and it said on the air front that no longer can be said. So it made a clear statement about the erosion of that capability on the part of Taiwan to ensure superiority over the Taiwan Strait. You have the ongoing question of the uncertainty of the provision of critical military weapons, technology parts, and software assistance from the outside, primarily of the United States. You have an internal procurement and defense strategy decision-making process that in the past, at least, has been highly subject to narrow service rivalries and viewpoints and external political and commercial influence of various types. And you've had and have very strong public differences in Taiwan over the necessity and the efficacy of significant new investments in military capability. Now, with all that as a backdrop, the Ma government faces politically a situation in which it has to walk a tightrope between all of these kinds of factors and more. The contradictory, to some degree, requirements of reducing tensions and establishing a more stable status quo with Beijing, which is its stated objective, maintaining a strong deterrence at the same time against Chinese coercion or aggression, strengthening economic stability and prosperity, which relies increasingly on the mainland for attaining that objective, maintaining Taiwan's international reputation, reassuring Washington that Taiwan will significantly enhance its defense capabilities while avoiding any provocative behavior that could upset U.S.-China relations. I mean, all of these things have to be balanced in Taiwan's defense strategy, and the QDR represents one element among many of trying to do that. And so let me just state some of the points that I think, and they relate to some of the things that Alexander has said, that attempt to get at these kinds of balances. The first and foremost is I think this document represents an attempt to build a more enduring and broader base of public and political elite support for continued defense modernization. Now, that sounds like a no-brainer given Taiwan's situation, but it's not. I mean, there are enormous amounts of division and dissension within Taiwan about how to proceed in defense modernization. And I think the one big attempt to try and deal with this is to establish this all-volunteer force to indicate that we're not going to have continued conscription, which has become increasingly unviable, We're going to try to transition to an all-volunteer force, and we're going to do so by December of 2014, and we're going to reduce the overall size of the force. This has, I think, positive implications for public support in general on this issue, but of course it raises a host of questions. I mean, where does the figure of 215,000 emerge from? I mean, what is that based on? What is going to be the distribution of the forces among the different services? Why is it 215,000? Why not 250,000? Why not 175,000? I mean, what is the metric by which this kind of number is arrived at and the process under which you are going to get to it? When you think about in 1997, Taiwan's total force size in terms of personnel was 425,000. It will be reduced now by over half of that amount. And yet at the same time, the ability of Taiwan to provide for its own defense is presumably going to increase. So the transition has to be towards technology, obviously, and the acquisition of appropriate technologies to make up for that loss and the strategy that you don't need to have so many boots on the ground and personnel to operate these systems and to defend the island. So the question is feasibility there and the number. The second, I think the QDR's function is to reassure to a certain degree Washington and to some degree even Beijing in several respects. One, by clearly stating that Taiwan's not about to consider any kind of larger WMD option in its defense stature. That was a clearly stated, that's been stated before, but it was clearly reiterated in this QDR. The second was to emphasize the highly defensive-oriented and certainly not preemptive-oriented strategy of defense that this QDR presents, the so-called hard rock notion, which has been presented earlier by the Ma government but then is enshrined in QDR, that clearly states we are no longer going to have the active defense or preemptive strike type of concepts that were thrown around so much during the rule of Chen Shui-bian. And at the same time, it clearly states that we're not going to go towards a porcupine strategy. We're not going to go towards the so-called porcupine strategy where we reduce significantly our air capabilities, we emphasize hardening, we emphasize the defense of the Taiwan territory itself. This QDR states that there needs to be a defense perimeter. There needs to be a buffer where we have capabilities that extend beyond our actual shores to defend against or deter against any kind of threat from the mainland. So there's a clear effort to sort of push back on that, and there was a lot of discussion about that whole concept some months ago, and I think this QDR tries to set to rest that notion as well. Now, at the same time, however, it does refer to the development of long-range strike and long-range precision engagement capabilities. It doesn't drop entirely the idea that the Taiwan military is going to have the capability to reach out and touch the mainland. Now, this has been presumably in the context of cruise missile capability, the Xiongfeng 2, Xiongfeng 3. Does it mean that, however, the QDR is now going to drop the idea of ballistic missile capability, of a short-range ballistic missile, the famous 1,000-kilometer ballistic missile capability that Taiwan has supposedly been developing for some time? Is that now for sure gone? And if that's the case, then are we talking then about limited cruise missile capabilities here? And if so, what is the purpose of those missiles? The emphasis in the QDR is to say we would never use anything first. We would certainly never do anything that would provoke any kind of action on the part of Beijing. But it still raises a host of questions in my mind about what is the doctrine within which this operates. Some observers have asserted that that the QDR actually gives up on the idea of air and sea superiority for Taiwan. I mentioned a minute ago that there's still a desire to have a perimeter, but is it to achieve or maintain air and sea superiority? But the QDR explicitly states that, quote, early intelligence, surveillance, and warning, long-range precision engagement, and joint multi-layer interception capabilities are needed in order to gain air dominance in desired airspaces and safeguard the sea and airspace of the Taiwan Strait. Okay, now what does that mean? I mean, does that mean we are going to maintain air superiority? That also is a question that I think is needs to be asked coming out of this QDR. Now, third, despite all the defensive orientation and the other points I've mentioned here, there certainly is the emphasis here that Taiwan is going to create a leaner, meaner military. It's not going to rely just on political detente with the mainland. It is not going to just rely on economic cooperation. As Alexander said, this is a comprehensive strategy, and the military plays a very significant role in that strategy. It is stated that the defense budget will be no less than 3% of GDP, although there could be some variation up and down depending on circumstances. But it lays out in this document what the five key goals of a leaner and meaner Taiwan military are supposed to be, what it calls resolute defense, which is military, civil defense, and regional security cooperation, undefined. I mean, what does that mean? Is that a reference to the United States, or is that a reference to a larger security structure of some type of cooperation that Taiwan is going to now engage in that it hasn't been doing before? It also mentions confidence-building measures across the strait as part of this defensive effort and this deterrence effort to try to enhance trust. It also refers to, among these goals, counter-blockade, maintaining sea and aerial lines of communication, joint interdiction, which is prevent approaching forces from approaching ROC territory, and then ground defense, which is the actual defense of the island itself. So it lays out these different functions there in a very clear way. I'll get to the question in a minute, though, of what that raises. Well, I can mention it now. Of course, the one question it raises is, what level of coordination with the United States has been undertaken in developing these sets of objectives? To what degree has this definition of Taiwan's strategy been developed in some level of consultation, close or otherwise, with Washington? And that, of course, you cannot tell from the QDR. Is this based upon a holding strategy? Is this a holding strategy essentially? Or is this something that's conceived of as larger than a holding strategy? Or is it intentionally vague because Taiwan doesn't know the answer to that question? That's an interesting point. And then fourth, the QDR certainly calls for the establishment of a military mutual trust mechanism, quote-unquote, between the two sides of the Taiwan Strait. MND officials have said that Taiwan, in reference to this, is working on creating a think tank or a liaison organization to coordinate contacts with the Chinese military to begin CBMs. Now, the question there, of course, is, I mean, what does that mean? I mean, how is that moving forward? Because there have been Ministry of Defense officials, including the Minister of Defense, Chen Chao-min, who said as recently as last month that, quote, Taiwan will not make concrete moves to reduce military tensions with China before the mainland renounces its threat to use force against the island and removes the missiles it has deployed against it, unquote. Is there a difference here between the Zhong Dongfu and the QDR statements on this and some people within the Ministry of Defense, including the minister? I don't know. What is the balance there is I think, needs to be clarified to some degree. And then finally, I think an interesting question is, how is all this to be implemented in terms of the important shifts and transformation that Alexander talks about here? I mean, this is a very, very big set of requirements that are placed on top of a huge set of requirements that the Taiwan military has been laboring under now for many years. And in one of the articles that Alexander has written on the QDR, he said that now should begin the work with local and international experts to formulate policy and programs and to explore monitoring and evaluation mechanisms to ensure the guidelines provided in this QDR can best be translated into effective deliverables. It sounds like there's got to be a lot of work done here to actually figure out what the details of this are going to be. There isn't necessarily a plan that has been developed in detail to implement what is being laid out here by way of general guidelines in the QDR. So I would be also interested in knowing how that is supposed to go forward. And those are my comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Raised some very, very interesting questions. But before we get to them, we're going to turn to Mark Stokes for his comments.
Thank you, Bonnie, Alexander, Michael, and group. Appreciate the opportunity to comment. As an initial set of comments, would like to commend the Ministry of National Defense and Alexander and others for the QDR. It was a good effort, and it was done, at a very, very appropriate time. It's a tough job. Anytime you do a report, and I've done sort of led the coordination effort on several reports to a Congress in our system, it's never an easy job. how to be able to develop a consensus not only within the defense establishment but also within with your civilian leaders and within other interest groups that may exist. It's never an easy job, and I think it turned out well, especially the first time that this effort's been done in Taiwan. It's a good time to do this exercise also because the situation is dynamic. It's about time that there's an effort to question fundamental assumptions, for example, and to review basic strategy. Taiwan faces a lot of challenges, and there's also a lot of opportunities in the offing. Some of the challenges that have been addressed already, but I guess to sort of put it in a nutshell, the PRC is gaining an ability to be able to use military force, exercise military force, to achieve its political objectives vis-a-vis the ROC or Taiwan in a way that's it's becoming easier to do. Increased military capabilities basically mean that it's easier to do and potentially could mean that more so willingness to use force if it ever came down to that. But it's not only directed against Taiwan, but also gaining the ability to be able to complicate foreign intervention on behalf of Taiwan. A lot of their force modernization efforts, for example, the anti-ship ballistic missile program, submarine programs, and a range of other efforts appear to be beyond Taiwan and increasingly could pose challenges for U.S. maritime operations, for example, in the Asia-Pacific region and the Western Pacific. So something to look at as well. So I mentioned the PRC challenges, other challenges as well that sometimes aren't mentioned, looking in a broader context. Challenges associated, for example, with the PRC's much more sophisticated strategy, for example, the three warfares doctrine that was established in 2003, a much more sophisticated strategy to be able to achieve their political objectives that don't necessarily involve military force. So there are other challenges, for example, Taiwan, something I'd like to mention as a side note, that the military challenge is not the only one that Taiwan faces. For example, natural disasters. I'd like to point this out. Taiwan, according to a World Bank study that was done in 2005, is the most dangerous place on Earth. The most dangerous place to be on Earth due to natural disasters. It's a great study if you haven't seen it, and it sort of opens your eyes that it's a dangerous place to be in Taiwan. Moving beyond that, but it's also a time of opportunity. The reduction of tensions that are going on these days does provide a chance to be able to do this sort of review and possibly look deep and make the necessary transformations so that Taiwan could find itself in a more secure situation in the future. So with this as a background, I would like sort of also sort of introduce another effort that's been going on that we've been involved in Project 2049, and working with AEI on doing what we would call sort of a Taiwan Defense Policy Working Group that was not necessarily connected with the QDR effort, but it was sort of a group of people that got together and decided to look and see what we could do in terms of coming up with some ideas on Taiwan strategy, inspired in part by retired Commander Bill Murray, paper that he published in Naval War College Review, that I actually thought was a well-done piece. I mean, you could debate some of the issues in there. But the positive thing is that it provided the basis for a good discussion on some of the fundamental issues associated with Taiwan's defense strategy. And so in our group, we incorporated two former Deputy Assistant Secretaries of Defense for strategy, three of us who were former predecessors of Joe Skinner, the audience here, in OSD ISA, or now it's called APSA. We have four former congressional staffers, as well as some other academics, as well as Commander Murray on our team, to be able to look at some fundamental issues and sort of take what Bill did a step further and go in much more detail. Talking about this a little bit in terms of some of the more high-profile or sort of sexy aspects, more interesting aspects of the effort. We first wanted to emphasize, for example, Michael mentioned about how Taiwan would view the role of the United States in terms of intervention, for example. We made an advocacy for Taiwan as a basic planning assumption to actually not assume U.S. intervention. You could hedge, for example, and also plan for ad hoc coalition operations with the United States, but as a fundamental planning assumption, it's actually safe to assume in their own planning that it'd be what you would call independent defense operations. So that's one. We also address a controversial issue that Michael addressed, having to do with some people would call offensive operations. I'm not sure if you can characterize operations as defensive or offensive in the modern-day world because of the nature of warfare and defenses, or offenses really depending upon what side of the gun you're looking at. One person's defense is another's offense. But we didn't really address this issue directly, but really wanted to define the battle space and make an argument that the battle space would be defined as wherever PRC attack operations or coercive or what you actually would call offensive operations against Taiwan would be coming from, and include that in the battle space. And to us, it's a legitimate requirement to be able to affect operations, PRC operations, within the whole range of the battle space. We're not advocating Taiwan adopt a quote-unquote offensive strategy or attack operations, but in terms of thinking about how you could include in your defense strategy ways to affect anything within that battle space, to us is a legitimate requirement. Another issue that we address, of course, would be things like arms sales and force modernization in general. We set out some general capabilities. In our assessment, we don't address specific weapon systems or products, so to speak, but we do address basic capabilities. Like, for example, in the air side, simply being able to have a sustained ability to prevent the PRC from having unimpeded access in the skies over the Taiwan Strait and Taiwan proper. For example, also maintaining at least a limited ability to be able to have access out to international waters, you know, corridors out from Taiwan's major ports. So we address some force modernization issues. We also make a point that, for example, on high-profile systems, in a perfect world, having some type of a very short takeoff and landing fighter is a legitimate requirement. We don't specify what kind. On the area of undersea warfare, we came up with a consensus that there is a valid requirement for submarines as part of a broader integrated architecture for example, situational awareness and for interdiction operations. So we address these sort of issues in the study that we did. We also address defense economics and defense industry. Felt that it's important in this day and age when you link, for example, Taiwan's sustained economic development, that it does become important to be able to think about how your defense spending does affect your economic situation, and there are ways to do it. Taiwan and Saudi Arabia right now are the two, what you would call security assistance partners, that rely so heavily on foreign military sales. And we make a point that maybe it's time to sort of do a review and look at, for example, the way that we did business, so to speak, in the 1980s, where you had a much larger component of domestic industry, a little bit less on foreign military sales. And one example that we give is in the area of submarines. Submarines is one example where we don't have submarines in our inventory today, but being able to go through the U.S. acquisition system on submarines may be worth reviewing see if there's alternative routes. We address, for example, cross-strait, what some people call confidence-building measures. We prefer to use the term risk reduction simply because the PRC is interested in enhancing Taiwan's confidence. We prefer to use terms like, for example, being able to reduce the risk of miscalculation or other accidental. So we're strongly in favor of engagement with the PLA. My impression is that there actually have been, for some reason people are calling this stuff new, my impression is that there actually has been dialogue between the two defense establishments, either informally or formally, that have been going on at least since the mid-1990s, and welcome contradiction or a sort of counterpoints to that. And then finally, we do go through and address some issues about U.S. ROC ad hoc coalition operations and some ideas on how to possibly move that ball forward. So with that, I'm turning back over to Bonnie and address questions.
Thank you very much, Mark. Before I open it up to the floor for questions, I think I will take the prerogative of the chair and pose one, since both Michael and Mark raised the question of confidence-building measures. Alex, perhaps you can tell us more about the thinking in Taiwan. Is there a division or differences in view between different parts of the Taiwan government and the military on this issue? Specifically, Michael raised the question of preconditions for engaging in confidence-building measures with the mainland. And then Mark raised the question of the purpose of CBMs. And when Chen Shui-bian was president, one CBM, for example, that was put forward was establishing a sort of no-fly zone around the center line. That would be a good example of something that would be a risk avoidance or accident avoidance measure. Is this the primary interest that that Taiwan has in CBMs, or is there also interest in developing better understanding, trust through exchanges? So I'll start with that question, and then we'll open up to the floor.
Sure. Very quickly, I think I'll make several points on CBM. Number one, I think the general ideas of the President Ma Ying-jeou is to reduce threat, or so-called not risk reduction, but threat reduction mechanism. I think the Ministry of Defense take that as a concept and have been trying to develop some measures or some approaches that the ministry can implement or can follow up. But I have to say it is still in the very early stage. To talk about human nature, lots of people in uniform do not want to get the responsibility to go ahead and shake hands with the PLA and suffer his own career. That's the human nature. And number two is that who will be our counterpart? If Taiwan does want to do it, who will be the counterpart on Beijing side? Is that the AMS, Academy of Military Science, or it's just an affiliated think tanks that closer to the PLA, or it will be done by the General Political Department? If we do not know who will be responsible on Beijing's side, I think Taiwan would be a little bit hesitant to designate a specific person or an office to have a full-fledged planning on doing this. Another point is that there are many retired generals still feel that they can contribute to the peace in the Taiwan Strait, and they are trying to competing against each other and to see that how many people they know on the other side so they can enjoy or compete for outsourcing studies programs issued by the Ministry of Defense. So in short, I would say it's in the very early planning stage. I think Taiwan is wide open to engage conversations with people who care about this business in this town. What I'm worrying, if I may shift a little bit to Michael Swain's question, is that when you look at the QDR, it's just like, very straightforward plan writing, no surprise document. But what I'm interested in is how the Ministry of Defense will build programs and do plannings based on these guidelines. And personally, I think it requires a very candid discussion between the Ministry of Defense and Pentagon here to develop a convergent agenda or a program that would not embarrass or antagonize each other. What I don't want to see is when Taiwan says something or have a policy and the United States will be forced to stand out and oppose it in public. But here is the dilemma. For instance, before my presentation, I was talking to Mike about the budget process. Taiwan's budget fiscal year goes with calendar. So all the agencies, ministries, would have to start drafting their budget sometime this month. And they have to complete their draft. and sent it to the executive yuan in June. But we know the Monterey has always been in July, and we have a lot of offices not manned with the desired nominee. And so there is a potential difficulty in the next several months that how Taiwan can find the right time and find the right people in the venue that not necessarily rest on the Monterey, because Monterey is cross-agency. But that's why I have been talking and advocating that there should be a senior-level defense, mini-defense dialogue to talk about all these. You know, if there is no such conversation, the case officer, the staff officer, will look at the last year's budget and put F-16 and submarines and everything that we did not get in the requirement again and make it public. And then the politician will jump on it, and sometimes in the crossfire, verbal crossfire, it may hurt the relationship. I think Taiwan MND is more than ready to sit down and discuss seriously with the American government on all these, and we do not want to engage with the early stage of the Obama administration with a bad start. I think Taiwan is ready, but we also have limited time, or otherwise we will see the defense ministry send up a budget that probably without a discussion with the U.S. government.
Thank you very much. Now we're going to open the floor to questions and comments. I ask that you identify yourself and your affiliation, and my apologies since I didn't identify myself. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Bonnie Glaser, and I'm a senior fellow with the Freeman Chair in China Studies here at CSIS. And the first person is Greg Mann, and you're welcome to comment if you wish on Alexander's statements, or you can just raise your own question. Please wait for the microphone.
Greg Mann, American Institute in Taiwan. First, a clarification for what one thing Mike said on missiles and ballistic missile programs, and then a question for Alex on cuts. It's kind of a mix. The ballistic missile program in Taiwan, the only program they have is the sounding rocket program under the National Science Foundation. There's some thought that could lead to a ballistic missile, but it's nowhere close. The 1,000 kilometer comes in with the Xiongfang 2E, which is a LACM cruise missile program. Just for Alex, looking at the numbers, 275,000 cut to 215, the three headquarters being consolidated and cut, you don't come up with the 60,000 personnel cut. What about the political warfare department? What about reports that the Taiwan Marine Corps is going to be cut by one brigade specifically the 66? Taiwan Air Force being cut by one wing. Is there any specifics on other cuts to reach the 60,000 personnel?
Well, I wish our OSD is here. With the reorganization and eliminate some of the commands, I think there have been a lot of discussions and debates within Taiwan military, and especially among services. I think the political warfare department will be kept. Why? Because we are afraid that the PLA would list the general political department as the counterpart for CBM talks. I would think Political Warfare Department would be perfect to be their counterpart. But I think, you know, to give you a more realistic answer on political warfare is that they have been transformed, not necessarily on the, political indoctrination, but more psyops and other functions. I think the rank and files of political warfare officers will fight to the very end to try to preserve their status. I think there will be a reduction in terms of personnel and lower the ranks, but there has been a plan to transform the department to a bureau under the Ministry of Defense. It's called Political Warfare Bureau. On the Marine Corps, well, it depends. I think I don't know. I have no clearance to look into anything juicy, but the Marine Corps is very strong in their voice. I think whether eliminating another brigade, I'm not sure. I think currently the force level is low enough for the Marine Corps, and I don't think there is a further reduction. Whether cut another wing of Air Force, of course, I don't have an answer. But the key, I think, in response to Greg's question is, where do you want to cut? You want to cut officers, you want to cut, enlisted men. Which section? You know, in the past, it has been a flat cut that each service has got the same share, and the commander of the army were given a ratio list and say, I want you to cut 10%. How to cut it is your business. And that was the way that we did streamlining before. But this time, I think the ministry tried to do it in a different way. I talked to a retired general, army general, and talk about this force cut. And he said, what's your view on this? I said, well, it's going to be very difficult. I think we need to think about the future warfare, the change of technology. And he just stopped me and said, cut the crap. You know, when I see the cut of the numbers, I'm thinking how many generals we should have. You know, right now, we with 275 personnel, we have more than 300 generals. And when the forces cut it to 200, around 200,000, how many generals do you want? You know, so, as a scholar, I don't want to scare my students who are in uniform and say, you got no future, you will never make it. But this is the truth. I think Minister Chen Zhaomin gave a talk to all senior generals and admirals yesterday and specifically warned them that there will be less billets for general and admirals and there will be cut on the top. So, and he asked everybody to get ready for the reality.
In the back on the left.
Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I'm trying to understand the implications of the QDR for procurement of U.S. arms in the coming years. And if I infer correctly, there may be an increased reliance upon high technology as force numbers go down. And while there is some change in strategic wording, I sense that it's uncertain what the impact of those changes would be. And I'm wondering whether you do expect increased efforts to buy U.S. arms, if so, where the money will come from, and whether there are any aspects of high-tech weaponry that Taiwan will forego as a result of changing strategy?
This is a perfect question for the ministry, because when I did this page, and I don't think it's an easy job to deal with all the challenges. I think several points. That's my personal reading. Number one, there will be no increase of defense budget under Ma Ying-jeou's term. So if you know about day-to-day body politics in Taipei, I don't think there will be anything beyond 3% of GDP. But if you look at the programs, if you talk to the different services, they will give you a long list, and that will cost more than 8% of the GDP. That's natural, okay? So the challenge is how to, you know, sit down and make it available and cut it down to 3% of GDP. And I think that's the difficult job of the minister. How to deal with the challenges as Taiwan think of high-tech systems? I think, interestingly, that probably, I don't think it's based on the exchanges with the PLA officers. There are different voices now in Taiwan, not necessarily active duty officers, are thinking of low-tech systems which can deliver. You know, 20 years ago, when Taiwan ships sail out from the Zuoyin port, you know, they were worrying about Romeo-class submarines from the PRC side. Yeah, they were very noisy and easy to get detected, but still, it's underwater. So long as the Romeo was operational 20 years ago, you got to alert, you got to do everything possible to protect your ship against the possible threat. So there are people thinking of that, given the limited resources that Taiwan can have, probably this is the right time, you know, since the cross-strait relations is getting improved. This is the right time for the military to think that whether we need to think all the high-tech system in the way that we only put the top-of-the-line or state-of-the-art frontier or first-tier systems as in our requirement list, or Taiwan should look into some low-tech but still poses threat against a possible invasion forces. That's another choice. So, you know, I don't think Taiwan is thinking of carrier or sea wolf. And I don't think Taiwan is thinking of huge submarines. I think maybe, you know, in the future, I won't be surprised if Taiwan come up with a concept that requiring only 20 to 30 men, you know, smaller, medium-sized, southern ton submarines. And that's the requirement, because our purpose is not to shoot down their vessels. We try to pose the threat and make them change their operational plan. Taiwan tried to defend itself, not attacking the Chinese forces. So there are a lot of changing ideas right now. And I hope that through discussions like Mark and others, when we scan through all these problems, challenges, and look at the possible resources that the military can get, you know, we may come up with a very interesting new idea. May not be asymmetrical, but it works for Taiwan. You know, we do not have a big ambition to occupy any islands from the Philippines, you know, or Japan, right? But we will use scarce resources to continue our modernization, so can we deal with the future threat? I think with this, I partially answer Michael's question.
I mean, what you ask is really, in my view, is at the heart of the problem that the U.S. faces in dealing with the arms sales issue. And now there are people in this room who know far more than I do about what the current state of this relationship is and how it relates to the question of arms sales. But I have, based on my research of some time ago, but it's to some extent been confirmed in fairly recent time by people who have been involved in it, at least at the political level, there has been a significant problem on the part of, well, there's been many problems, but one important problem has been, I don't know the best way to put it, a lack of confidence on the U.S. side that the kind of decisions that are coming out of Taiwan in terms of what they think they need to have by way of U.S. assistance is based upon a genuine, merit-based, comprehensive, strategically oriented assessment of their needs. And that in the past, that evaluation had been pushed and driven to a very high degree by very narrow kinds of interests of one sort or another, be they service, political, commercial, whatever. And therefore, there has always been a strong need, I think, among at least some people in the U.S. side, to have Taiwan come up with a genuinely more enduring strategic concept that clearly explains why they need certain types of weapons when. Well, I mean, that's a high benchmark, but it's one that I think the Ma government is trying to get towards with this QDR. At least that's what I'm told, and that's what one might presume from it. But I'm not sure that is having the – it's maybe it's too soon to say, but it may not yet have the desired effect. Now, even if you have that process, right, and the Taiwan government is able to reassure Washington that its requests are based upon the kind of strategic logic that Washington thinks should be applied, you still have the problem on the U.S. side, of course, about whether or not it's going to evaluate this or that request. It doesn't just evaluate each request in terms of the narrower sort of strategic need of Taiwan. Let's be frank about it. I mean, there are a variety of different considerations that come to bear when the U.S. assesses requests from Taiwan. The strategic one is a very, very important one in terms of Taiwan's needs, but there are also other ones. And that, you know, that's, you're not going to get over that with Taiwan resolving its side of the problem. But it's a question to my mind whether or not Taiwan, in fact, you know, has provided the right kinds of signals and is being reassuring, if that's the right word, through the QDR and other means, such that Washington says, hey, this is great. They're moving in the right direction. We have a better understanding here. We're more confident that what they need is something they really need, and it's not going to vary when a new chief of staff comes into power. Or you have a new administration that moves in and their priorities shift right back again to some other area. And that's, you know, I don't know what the answer to that is. Greg does, but he won't say.
Let me just make a very quick comment on the arms sales issue. I'm a strong advocate of arms sales. It's a good thing. It's sort of represents U.S. support for Taiwan, and it's consistent with U.S. principles outlined in the Taiwan Relations Act. Having said that, though, to me, one of the problems with thinking about Taiwan's military in the context of arms sales, you know, the first thing that comes up when you think about Taiwan military in the United States is the arms sales issue. For give an example, for example, you look at a military challenge that Taiwan faces, land attack cruise missiles. Land attack cruise missiles, in many ways, are more serious than the ballistic missiles. They're much more accurate, they're less expensive, and in many ways, they're harder to deal with. But with land attack cruise missiles, the first thing that comes up, and you know, for example, in Taiwan's defense establishment in the U.S. for that matter, is, okay, how do we deal with the cruise missile problem? So, okay, let's figure out, okay, what does the United States use? Let's sell SLAM RAM or whatever. And very little that goes on in terms of, okay, let's look at the problem in general, because the United States solution, for example, for cruise missile defense, we're actually not that good at it. We don't face a huge cruise missile defense problem. Taiwan faces the most significant land attack cruise missile problem in the world. So instead of just automatically looking at the U.S. solution, you step back and you go through a thought process of looking at the whole kill chain. What do you require, for example, in terms of sensors? What do you require in terms of command and control and, for example, fusion of information or correlation of track data, for example, a survivable sensor architecture? What do you need to engage it? What type of interceptor? How do you develop a layer of defense? The whole thought process, and then figure out, well, are the things that we can do within Taiwan itself, working with, for example, U.S. Technology assistance, or do you just go take the simple, easy route, and you just automatically do the knee-jerk reaction, and you figure out what's on, you know, you look at the brochure and the product list, and you just go to the United States with the LOR letter of request, and you put it in the system. What we're advocating is somewhat of a more rational, strategic approach to some of the issues, and in many cases, buying off the shelf through foreign military systems, through the more foreign military sales system may be appropriate, and sometimes it may not.
I'm going to take two questions, first from Chris Nelson and then from Bud Cole.
Thanks, Bobby. The part of the discussion that just fascinates me hits on something that I think all of us who've been involved in Taiwan stuff for whether it's 5 years or the last 100 years is the level of serious discussion and serious consultation and what level can you conduct it at before other factors get into play, you know, certain people across the street, you know, start getting upset about it. And I don't know enough about it. It might be useful if you guys could take a second to talk about what level of defense consultation has taken place. Do you have indicators that the Obama folks, when they're in place, wish to increase that? Or is it satisfactory now? It just doesn't get much publicity. We don't know about it. You know, what is the consultation situation? What would you like to see from the Obama Defense Department and State Department and NSC, for that matter, start to carry out to meet these goals? Because I was particularly taken by Alex's point that it's a lot more consultation really is needed. And yet, obviously, from what he was saying, it hasn't taken place or it isn't taking place at the right level. So,
Alexander, thank you. My question has to do with increased pay. And I agree with you that the defense budget is unlikely to increase, given the lack of fighter pilots, the previous failure of the ROTC program, the failure of the 2003 all-volunteer experiment. How much of a pay increase is being proposed to attract volunteers?
Well, but question first. Based on President Ma Ying-jeou's own words, the pay level will be at least double of the basic wages, which will make it probably 1,000 U.S. 1,000 U.S. per month. For enlisted, it's pretty high because college graduate cannot make that in the first 2 years outside of the college. So it's considered high. But again, how to make it available? You know, partly I want to respond to you and Michael's question was that how can you do it with a limited, resources, financial resources, and that requires studies. And the experience that we need to learn from others. And that's why I put in my newspaper article saying that we need to involve domestic and international expertise in various studies. For instance, all voluntary forces, how are you going to implement it? How you integrate this with a refined NCO program? And how do you need to change the PME system? Because it's quite scary that once the all volunteer forces is implemented, then you won't have a college graduate as a platoon leader, right? Because they are not required to serve for as current like 11 months. Then where do you find the second lieutenant or ensign in the Navy, where did they come from? You know, the basic wages you're a new recruit for all volunteer forces are the enlisted, are the seamen. But the junior officer rank is a basic, it's a big problem. I think in terms of manpower personnel, I think there could be lots of contract studies that have been done in the coming years that are issued by the Ministry of Defense, either for domestic contractors or for foreign contractors on all these issues. Now back to Chris. Consultation, of course, consultation is more consultation is better. But I also know that there are political limitations given the relationship between the United States and Taiwan. What I would like to see is that I think the intentions are right and good right now. I think the Obama team and the expected people who are responsible in this business are with good intentions. And I think Ma Ying-jeou's team is also with good intentions. Right now, we need to sit down and at least some people, or at least one person per each side, needs to sit down and compare calendars. You know, whether we need what kind of dialogue. You know, Taiwan can always post the request and say, we want to send this guy in, or we want to talk about this. But you have to work with the agendas and calendars on both sides. And I hope that in the future there could be a kind of conversion agenda, you know, that works with Taiwan's budget, you know, cycle, and work with the political agenda here, and try to find a good way to do it. In short, I don't think an annual Monterey is enough, and especially today we are talking about defense. I think annual defense the review talks is not enough. I want to see more engagement. But at what level that the United States feel comfortable, and at what level that Taiwan feel comfortable to send out and to say something that can become deliverables when he travels back. I think at least at this high senior level, we should have one meeting in the near future to define all that.
I would just comment that I think it's important to try to understand that there's a, I think everybody's aware of this, but I mean there is a dynamic here that is at work that complicates this issue tremendously. That goes far beyond just U.S. Taiwan, and of course involves Beijing. I mean, you currently have a situation now where Beijing is taking a what seems to be quite a tough position on U.S. assistance to Taiwan. It came out of the decisions made at the end of the Bush administration on notification of the seven different systems, but it has not just passed. There is a persistence on Beijing's side to make an issue of this. And the question there, of course, is, I mean, to what degree and in what way? You know, what is Beijing potentially going to lay out there in terms of leverage, if you will, in dealing with this issue, and that remains somewhat unclear. But it's been said to me that the Obama administration doesn't want to get caught in the situation in which Taiwan, on the one hand, develops a more comprehensive and persuasive, systematic argument in favor of greater assistance, and it pushes forward with this, while the mainland stands there and says, if we see any more signs of this deepening of the relationship, there's going to be more serious consequences. It's going to get even more serious. Now, Washington's response to this has been, as I understand it, well, Beijing, if you don't make a change, in what you're doing in terms of your own military buildup on this, our hand will eventually be forced. I mean, ultimately, we will have to proceed with serious consideration of providing assistance, further assistance to Taiwan, because we're obligated to do that, and we will have to do that. So it comes back around again, really, to some degree, to cross-strait relations. It comes back around to the question of are Taiwan and the mainland going to develop their relationship in ways that have an impact on Beijing's own behavior in this area, such that Washington get out of this situation, can back away from or avoid this kind of a trap, which it doesn't want to be in. And that's, I think, where a lot of this, you know, that's kind of the situation we're in now. Even though, I mean, I don't think there's a sense of urgency about it, as I sense it in the Obama administration, that, you know, we have to make it. I mean, I don't think there's going to be any pending decision here in the coming months about this problem, either upgrading the level of contact with Taiwan or providing, you know, arms sales. But it's one that is inherent in the dynamic that the three sides are confronting right now.
We've already run past time, but I'm going to give Alan Romberg 30 seconds.
So I just would refine what Michael just said. I don't think the issue is whether there will be arms sales in terms of what happens in cross-strait. I think the issue is no, but also what. But I think the notion that there won't be arms sales is not, you know, I wouldn't. Well, you left the impression that the U.S. would like to get out of the middle of this, and that suggests no arms sales. Okay. Good. Okay.
Say what?
We need the money.
I don't want to leave it on a commercial note here. Go ahead, Mark, please.
Just one quick follow-on to Michael and to Chris and Alan. I would advocate on the arms sales issue, and also getting back to what Alex mentioned, I would advocate serious consideration of bringing back the annual U.S.-Taiwan arms sales talks. And there's a whole rationale that I would have for this, and I may get spears for actually raising this, but to me that's something worthy of consideration, to be able to have that front and center and address serious issues rather than the way that we've been doing over the last 8 years. That's it.
Well, I think that opens a whole host of issues, but given the fact that the U.S. government has been reluctant to accept a letter of request in the F-16s, it's not surprising that people might share your opinion that it might be better for Taiwan to go back to the old system. Before I close, I'd just like to mention we will be holding here at CSIS on April 22nd an event to mark the 30th anniversary of the Taiwan Relations Act, and we'll be discussing its current relevance and importance going forward. And with that, please join me in thanking Alexander Huang, Michael Swain, and Mark Stokes.